You're listening to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Strap yourself in and get ready. Here is Scott Zielinski and Wes Boss.
Welcome to Syntax, the podcast with the tastiest web development treats out there. Today, we've got a potluck for you, which is where you send us questions. We will attempt to answer them. Haven't done one in a while, since before we took our summer break. So we have tons of really good questions. If you've got a question, please send it over. We really appreciate it. Go to syntax.fm, top right-hand corner, click a button, says submit a potluck question. You do the rest, and we will attempt to answer it on the show. Today, we are sponsored by three awesome companies: Linode, Cloud Computing Developers Trust; Sentry, which is error exception performance tracking; and Auth0 does sign in and permissions management for your application. We'll talk about all of them partway through the episode. How are you doing today, Mr. Scott Zielinski?
Hey, yeah, I'm doing good. I'm just getting woken up here on a Monday morning, getting ready to go, getting my ready to start the week. It's going to be a fun one, as every single week is, but I'm going to be working on some neat features for the admin stuff in Level Up. And you know what? I really love working on that kind of stuff. I don't know about you, but there's something like really great about working on like kind of fun and interesting UI challenges.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
also ones that are just made for you and your team, because you can like experiment a little bit more. You can play around a little bit more with some of the UIs, and you don't have to be always thinking, does this look absolutely perfect? Does this work absolutely perfect? I can get around this. I can just try out some new fun things and experiment with it.
I love the admin tooling side of things.
Oh yeah. One of my favorite jobs was when I worked for Ford and we just did prototyping designs the whole time. Like that was my whole thing, is a designer would design something and then I would get to just code out a really rough version of it to have people check out. And it was something so freeing about knowing that nobody was going to be using this except for like some people who are just trying to feel, you know, there's just like a little bit of it's a little bit more rough and rugged. So yeah, that kind of stuff is a lot of fun for me.
We should do a show on that, because often I meet devs who work at large companies and you say, oh, like, what do you work on? And they almost always say internal tooling, because like, I bet like if you look at a big company like Uber, I bet the amount of code that is written for their internal tools for administrating all of their data and everything is probably just as big as the actual application that is consumer pointed.
Yeah, totally. There's some neat stuff in there too. Oftentimes the internal tooling is like where some really interesting things go down, because, you know, you can take a little bit more risks. So cool. Let's get into it with the hardest question anyone's ever asked us on this show. This question is from Todd. This question says, hey guys, I love the podcast. Thank you, Todd. This is a silly question and possibly the least important potluck question you will ever get. When you get a new Apple device, like an iPhone, Apple Watch, MacBook Pro, do you keep the box? Yes. Why or why not? No, I do not keep the box unless I'm planning on selling it at some point in the future. If it's a device that I would say like, oh yeah, this is something I'm going to use myself and not intend on selling ever, no, I'm going to throw that box away. I don't care about the box. Me, not a box fan. I don't care. Yeah, I only keep them if I'm going to be selling them, because I know that they do sell for more with the box. It's still weird to me, but I understand why. But yeah. I don't care about the box.
I tweeted this out a couple weeks ago and it causes a huge uproar, and I included it with another thing. So I'm going to ask you, you buy eggs at the grocery store. Do you open them up and check them?
Yes.
Oh, so you're not a box keeper, but you're an egg checker.
Oh, yeah. Wow. You don't want to get home and have a broken egg. Who does that? You got to check the eggs. You got to pull the corn back a little bit to make sure it's good. You got to check the eggs. You got to do all that stuff.
All right, let's talk about the corn in just a second, but boxes. I don't keep any boxes unless I do keep the iPhone boxes. I said on Twitter, I don't keep any boxes, just live your life. And it's very freeing to just throw the box out. Also, my wife hates it. When I get something new, I'll try to open the box like the wrong way, like rip it from the bottom or something like that. It drives people crazy. There's another subset of people that just keep every single box for like an alarm clock that they're never gonna, you're never gonna return it or whatever. Just who cares? Like if something happens, you just tell the company, I don't know, I threw the box out. Like, wait, you're not gonna take this back? And a lot of people are scared of that happening. So no, I don't keep a box for anything except for my iPhones. I throw all the computer boxes out as well, just cause like if I'm gonna sell that, I'm gonna sell it to somebody I know or pass it down.
Maybe it's just cause like our house had no storage space. Like our previous house, this new one's a little bit different. We got some closets here. We had one closet and it was the under the stairs closet, which was like tiny. And it's just like, where am I supposed to keep that stuff? I don't want to, you know, like, I don't want a closet full of boxes. It's dead air.
It's not worth having that, the stress of having all of these boxes and having to maintain them and whatnot.
Yeah, I don't got room for that.
I don't check my eggs. I decided a while ago, I'm just going to live my life and throw it to the wind. Sometimes you get a broken egg, like once or twice a year. That's fine. You get 11 eggs. Not a big deal. I don't have time to sit there and open them all up and check them. It's very freeing just throwing it to the wind. And what was the last one that we were talking about?
The corn husk. You pulled back the corn husk.
This is a weird thing. You pull it back. So in Ontario, it's very common to shuck the entire cob and leave everything in the big bin at the grocery store. And when COVID hit, they had to implement these massive signs, shuck at home for safety of everyone. Mm. And everyone was up in arms because like...
Seems polite.
Yeah, I shuck at store. I'm a store shucker.
Mm. I would shuck at home, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a peaker. I would shuck at home. It's weird with the eggs, you know. I understand leaving it to the universe and just being like, all right, I guess 11 eggs, that's fine. Yeah. That's pretty cool. I get that. And I can see how that's freeing. What I'm not is I'm not like pulling out the magnifying glass and really looking. I'm going to pop it open. I'm going to say, is there any major damage in here? No major damage. We good. I'm not turning each egg over for abrasions or, yeah.
You know what you got to do? You don't grab one that looks like it's been moved because somebody else has checked it and put it back.
Mm.
You got to go one for that's like sitting.
Go in the stack.
Yeah. And it's like 98% chance you buy, you're good.
That's some scientific math. Let's see those studies, Wes.
I was just trying to do the math. Well, just like personal anecdote. That's where I get my science from.
Yeah, me too.
Anyways, that was a great question. Thank you, Todd. Next one is from Gonzalo Diaz. Hey, guys. Awesome podcast. Do you go over the advantages or disadvantages of using local images versus external image services? Example, Cloudinary for displaying images on a web app. This is a really good question because... it used to be that you just had one image, you resized the thing, or maybe you had like a Photoshop batch where you would just resize them and upload them. But now we're in a time where often it's a good idea to ship multiple versions of that, or you want to automatically detect. Like I remember doing WordPress websites and I would have sliders and people would upload the image and they'd be like, the face is cut off of the person. And I'd be like, well, just crop it appropriately. But now you can... I know Sanity has this built in where you can draw a circle around the thing that matters. Cloudinary, I'm pretty sure, has person detection based on cropping. So there's major advantages, at least I think, into using an image service, both for resizing, for compression, for performance, for new image formats and using a service. I know Cloudflare just rolled out their image service as well, which means that this is the type of thing that is going in. Trying to host your own version of that type of thing can totally be done, but it is very easy just to reach for a service like that as well. What do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting because the services are easy. And one of the things I really like about it is just images, they take up space, they have complexities, and the services just being able to say, all right, here's the URL string and quality auto, format auto, and, you know, literally just you take care of it.
Yeah.
That to me is extremely nice. And it depends on who you are and what your project is that you're doing. But me personally, I really like the experience of using Cloudinary. The only problem is it's just like now you've added one more service to your stack.
Yeah.
So if you're keeping tally, you kind of got to keep this tally of, all right, what am I willing to put into a service and what am I not willing to put into a service? And maybe it's worth it to run your own version of Cloudinary because it's really probably not that hard to have a S3 bucket and a serverless function do it. There's guides out there on the internet how to write your own type of thing, but then that's something you got to manage. So it's all about what's your budget to deal with this stuff versus what's your time to deal with this stuff. You got a lot of developers, somebody can, you know, handle image hosting and all that stuff for yourself. Then by all means, you can manage it internally. We're a small business. And it's really difficult for us to have the workforce to be able to focus on those type of things. So to have a service with that kind of features for us and just pay for it is easy. And so I like that ease of use. But again, side projects and stuff, I'm probably just reaching for local images and not worrying too much about it. You know, a lot of the things that modern front end stacks, like I know there's Gatsby image. Next.js has an image thing. Vite has an image thing.
Yeah.
Those kind of tools are really great. And I think that's definitely where you'd go if you weren't doing something like this. But to me personally, the ease of use of a service makes it a feature that I personally use.
If you do decide to go and host it yourself, like my own westboss.com, I wanted to go full, like run it myself, except for obviously hosting. So I opted to use Gatsby Image, which Gatsby Image does all of your images as a part of your build. And I have thousands and thousands of images on my website. And if I have to clear the cache on that thing, it's like almost an hour to build my website, which is brutal. And really the only option is to go with a service that does it on demand or build your own and then also have it done on demand. Because on demand is not a big deal, because what happens is somebody visits a blog post that no one has ever been to, and you ask for 800 by 600. The service is going to say, oh, I've never done that of that image. Let me grab the original, quickly resize it, and then throw it out the door. And the first person that visits that page is going to be a little bit slow. But then after that, that image has already been cooked up and it's on the shelf ready to go for the next person that comes to that website.
Yeah. And there is something about the caching, the auto format, the smallest format, the smallest size possible, all that stuff to me is what makes it worth it, because you are getting the fastest images possible in my experience.
Yeah.
All right. Next question here is from Jill. And this is a long one, so stick with me, but this is a good one. So Jill says, hey, Scott and Wes, a 40-year-old lady looking forward to make a career change. It's taken me a year plus, but after building several tutorial React apps, I finally built a full stack JavaScript app on my own with lots of rad Postgres database stuff and a bunch of Node and Express API endpoints, role-based access control, fancy OAuth, and of course, the latest React tech. Cool, man. Jill's doing a ton of stuff. Yeah, wow.
Good job. Jill's on fire. That's much faster than I learned any of that stuff.
Holy cow. I'm pretty proud of it. You should be, Jill, by the way. I even managed to configure Nginx and deploy to AWS. The only problem is it looks like crap. My portfolio is pretty darn slick. I used a gorgeous Gatsby template that required only a bit of tweaking, but the site I architected and worked so hard to bring to life, it looks like an 8-bit video game for toddlers. It's responsive, a responsive yet bootstrappy game. Okay, my question, does this matter? I would hope that this project shows off my back-end skills, but I'm afraid they'll judge a book by its cover, and they may. I guess the second question is, how do you show off your back-end skills? I have a README in my repo, but will they actually read it? Or can you be a full-stack React developer with no design skills? I'm a very, very ready to apply for jobs emotionally and financially, but I'm terrified of making a fool of myself and worried that I'll never get hired. I'm completely self-taught and have been plugging away on my own for the pandemic. So I send a massive thank you to you guys for the sense of community that your show provides, and props to the wise sprinkler controllers. Okay, this is a long one. And it's really, really interesting. So Jill's issue is that she's built this big old fancy thing, but she's not a designer, which, let's face it, most developers are probably not designers, right? We usually work with designers, and some people are more design focused. Yes, absolutely. A lot of us work with designers to build things in the real world. So that's a thing. But in the same regard, there is something to be said about first impressions of when somebody looks at your thing. Is it going to be like, oh, this looks good, or it doesn't look good? So Jill, my suggestion to you would be to find some sort of an open source UI, anything that matches whatever your project is. And just, if it's open source, it's free to use, whatever, just copy it. Just find something that's out there that is available to be used and just copy it, make it look nice. You know, the skills that oftentimes people are hiring, we mentioned this before, would be like, can you replicate a design pixel perfect? It's like somebody's going to look at it and say, it's not about, did Jill design this? Because that's not important. But if she was able to take a design that looked nice and replicate it, make it look nice, then that's what they're going to be looking at, is like, can you work with a design that exists, and can you like re-implement that in code? So I think you should focus on the design somewhat, but you don't need to design it yourself. That's not something you need to do. Another thing is, if people are going to hire you for backend work, they will look at your code more than anything else. And just worry about the cleanliness of your code, comments, formatting, those types of things will make a bigger difference, I think, than the UI of the site would.
Yeah, I agree with everything Scott said. Is just get a good template that you can apply to it, because people are going to look at it and be like, this is not what it is. And it, clearly you just impressed us by rattling off all the stuff that you've learned in the last year, which is very impressive that you're able to do both the backend node, the JavaScript app on the front end, as well as all the server-y stuff, AWS, Nginx, OAuth, all that stuff. So it's very impressive. So like, I would even play that up in terms of like a don't judge this book by its cover and say like, you should see the back end and like, just like really go home on that, being like, like, don't be embarrassed by it at all. Be like, I'm really good at this type of thing. And I've used a template for the front end, and look, I've implemented it perfectly as well.
Totally.
Beautiful.
And keep in mind too, is if you're new coming to development, you know, I know you're doing a lot of stuff, but I think you're going to find less opportunities for full stack work as a new developer. I think a lot of times that full stack work comes for maybe people who have had a little bit more work opportunities. Not saying that you can't get it. It just might be a little bit more challenging. So maybe pour everything into either the front end, back end, whatever you find most interesting, and really go hard on those aspects when trying to get that first role, just so you can say like, this is what I can do really well.
Next question we have here from Fabian. Scott, I just finished your Svelte Kit course and now I'm working on building Svelte components. I have a question regarding testing. I was listening to an interview with Rich Harris on Svelte Radio, and it's my understanding that the framework is trying not to be opinionated as far as testing. What are you doing as far as testing with Svelte Kit? Do you have any recommendations, plugins, blah, blah, blah? I've only ever written unit tests with Jess in view. I'm loving Svelte, but I really want to work on writing more tests. And there's a couple more sentences that says, I think it says the same thing. So yes, Scott, what does the testing scene look like in Svelte land?
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny. I wanted to include this one because I just saw this question on Twitter the other day too. So people are asking about it. We personally don't do any Jest testing for our UI at all. Not because you can't do it in Svelte, but because I just don't like it. We did it largely for React, and I found it to be just not the most reliable for testing. But then again, you know, I think different teams work differently in that regard. We use Cypress to do all of our tests. And in that regard, Cypress does not care about what the UI layer was. The reason why that worked out really well for us is that we were able to literally change the front end JavaScript framework that our site was built in, and all of our tests were able to be kept the same. In fact, we did not rewrite our tests. We just rewrote the code so that the test passed, which was pretty amazing if you think about it.
So you're essentially just testing that the buttons click and the HTML is rendered, right?
Yeah. And we're mocking the API the same. So like, I mean, you're using data test IDs in the code so that you can attach onto something in the DOM and say, you know, click this button here or there. That way Cypress can still find it. So I would honestly recommend that approach, but that doesn't mean that you can't do the other approach as well. In fact, testing library, you know, of React testing library fame, there is a Svelte testing library that works with Jest and Svelte. And again, these testing libraries are so great because it is mostly focused on the DOM and not focused on Svelte. And the things that the testing library for Svelte is doing is basically just allowing you to render the component, right? You render the component, then you check the DOM to see what it does. And the only thing that Cypress is doing differently is it's just firing it up in the browser rather than rendering the component via Node. So the testing scene is largely the exact same in the React world, sans like something like Enzyme or something, which honestly I didn't use anyway. So you have testing library, so Svelte testing library in Node if you want to do it that way, or you can do it the same way we did it and just do Cypress for everything for the UI. But either way, I didn't find anything different or odd in the testing of Svelte components compared to React components. And another thing that wouldn't be any different is authentication. If you were using a service like Auth0, Wes, do you want to talk more about Auth0 and why service for authentication might be a good idea?
Yeah, Auth0 is the easiest way for devs to add authentication and secure their application. They provide features like user management, multi-factor auth, and enable you to let your users log in with like pretty much any way you want. You want to log in with Google, Twitter, Discord, whatever. You got it. You want to customize a login page? you got it. You want to integrate it with Node.js and Svelte or React and Next.js, you got it. They integrate with pretty much everything out there, and they've got a really good set of APIs for integrating with whatever you can imagine. Some really cool stuff that they have is device biometrics. If you want to log in with the face ID or use your fingerprint, or what other types of biometrics are there? A retina scan, maybe? You name it, they got it. So if you're looking to integrate Auth and user management into your application, check out Auth0 at, this is a pretty sweet domain name, a0.to/syntax. Thank you, Auth0, for sponsoring.
Sick. Next question is from Adam. Adam says, hi, Wes and Scott. I'm weak when it comes to DevOps. I would like to confidently set up and deploy my applications on AWS and manage dev and prod environments. Any recommendations on how to learn this, how this all works, so I really understand? If you don't personally, can you tweet at this out so other developers can share their thoughts? Okay, Adam, let me tell you, in my opinion, the best place to find this kind of stuff is in the DigitalOcean blog, in my experience. I don't know about US, but the DigitalOcean, their blog has been really, really good for me to learn this type of thing, because I think specifically they have the best guides on how to not only set up a virtual private server, set up different services, set up different servers or Nginx or whatever you need, right? And in my experience, their posts are very direct in a good way. They don't add too much fluff, but they add just enough fluff to explain things. But they also add in and make sure that security is very high on, you know, they'll say, all right, now we're doing this. Now you need to remove access from the root user, add this, do that, whatever. And they explain all very wise. So I would check out the DigitalOcean blog and really look into some of their beginner stuff about running a virtual private server, or I think it's their like knowledge docs might be it.
The DigitalOcean stuff is not specific to just DigitalOcean. It's specific to literally any Linux server. You could host it on AWS. They'll give you a Linux server. One of our sponsors today, Linode, will give you a Linux server, and you can put all these things on there. It's funny, that type of thing seems to be going more of the way of using services. But we talked about this with Matt from Caddy, very firm believer that these are still really good skills to have in being able to log in and run Nginx or run PM2 is a popular one that I use myself, Docker, things like that. They're very good skills to have. Next question we have here is from Kanye West. You have both That's a good one.
It's very funny.
You have both praised MDX in the past, but why would you use it? So MDX is Markdown, but with JSX in it. I understand it lets you put JSX in your Markdown, but that seems counter to the purpose of using Markdown files for content. Markdown is portable format for static content and independent of any front-end framework. That makes it a good choice for writing posts and rendering them. Once you inject a React component, doesn't that eliminate the portability and the static nature of Markdown? At that point, why don't you just use a dynamic website where you have complete control over how the content as rendered? What are your thoughts? So this is a good point. Like, as soon as you start to use like another flavor of something, then it becomes very hard to move that somewhere else. And that's already an issue with Markdown. I'm not sure if you know, but as soon as you get into it, there's GitHub flavored Markdown. Yeah. There is, what's the daring fireball? Marco Armin. So he's the guy that made Markdown, and he hasn't touched the spec in like 10 years or so. And I don't think he has any, there's a lot of things that are missing from Markdown. So that's why people come out with the GitHub flavored Markdown. And there's a couple other versions of Markdown. So there already are, you can already take Markdown from one format and it doesn't work like you would expect it in another format, which is frustrating. And then you're adding, all of a sudden you're adding React components in the middle of your Markdown. Like, why would you do that? Well, personally, why do I use it? Because it's super easy to, it's a great way to write your documentation. And then if you need to be able to throw in a video player, which there's no video player in Markdown. Like, a good example is I'm writing a blog post. My entire blog is written in MDX. If I want to throw in a video player or a graph or anything that is anywhat dynamic, another example is if I want to put in an advertisement for my courses and I'm having a sale and I want to inject whatever course is currently on sale in the middle of 1,000 blog posts, how do I do that? You know, like then all of a sudden you need some sort of like server side includes. Well, that's pretty easy to do with JSX. So yeah, you do get away from it. And there are some efforts to sort of port what MDX is to other frameworks. But I don't know how well that would work just because there are so many millions of different plugins for MDX. But I think that's better than just what doing the other thing, which is hand coding your paragraph tags and wrapping your links and with all the correct attributes and automatically applying or manually putting IDs on all of your headers. Like that's a nightmare for writing blog posts if you've ever done that. So I much rather write it in Markdown. And then if I ever move off of React and that, I'm going to have to do a little bit of work to make sure that my components now work in whatever framework I'm in, but it's worth it to me.
Yeah, I think there might be like a difference in understanding like why people use these tools, because for me, it isn't just, you know, static content that you can move anywhere, but like it almost is more of a like a template.
Yeah.
Templating language, right? What is like the templating language you used to use? Was Pug? There was like EJS.
I still use Pug. What was it called before that?
I don't know. There's been Jade. A whole bunch of different ones. Jade. Oh, yeah. Jade, Pug, Haml. Pug. Yeah. And these templating languages, they don't exist to make things more portable. Really, they make things that like make it easier to parse or read or look through like your code and read it as a blog post. Because the Markdown post is way easier to read as Markdown than it is with HTML markup. So, you know, it is for me personally, I look at these as being like, what can we do to simplify the UI code to see in MDX or any of these likewise Markdown with components libraries? Definitely fall into the realm of what can we do to make these things easier? But like you said, it's a lot of times it is used for things like blog posts when you want to insert a video, right? And that's really where the ease of use comes out of there for you. Oftentimes, you know, you're writing your stuff in Markdown if you are a developer. Some people definitely aren't. You're writing it through a CMS or something like that. I think that's a totally different world. But we have some fairly static pages on our Level Up tutorial site, right? Like the About page. Does that About page need a whole bunch of HTML markup? Like, I don't think so. It'd be like really prime character for like a Markdown file that you could just convert to HTML automatically. All right. Next question here is from Zach Z. Zach Z says, "Hey, Wes and Scott, I like you both. Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, that's not what he was saying.
I, like you both, am a developer with young kids."
Doesn't like us.
No, he doesn't like us. "I have three boys age 6 and under." That's a lot of boys age 3, 6 and under. "Needless to say, my house has a lot of energy in it. My job is quite flexible, which I appreciate because it gives me the freedom to structure my day to help out my family. My question for you both is, as a web developer with a spouse and young kids working from home, how do you both maintain a healthy work-life balance, avoid working too much, find time for yourselves, family, etc.?" Yeah, this one's tough because the kids, if they're home, they require kind of just a ton of effort, just constantly. So for me, I'm a little bit newer of a dad than Wes. My kids are 2 and 4. So Wes, you've had a little bit more time than this with me. But for me, it's been really a challenge to not open my computer on the weekend like I was used to before and like really save it for kids are in bed or whatever. Sometimes I have problems with it where I'm like, you know, it's like 5 o'clock and I don't want to stop working because I'm in the middle of like a bug or something like that. But the kids are home and, you know, I don't want to just put it all on my wife unless there's an emergency or something, right? So for me, it's largely been about really making my work time schedule. That is my work time and I'm not working any other time. And every once in a while here, I'll take a Friday off or I'll take a Thursday off or I'll take any day off that I can to spend the time. Because our kids go to daycare during the day, so they're not home at the house during the day. But making sure that those times that they are home, whether that is right when they get home from daycare or on the weekends, that I am as present as possible rather than being wrapped up in work. So yeah, that's really just it, is setting those hard boundaries to say like, you know what, if I'm going to be doing for fun programming, I'm going to be doing it in my for fun time, which is after the kids are down to bed or something.
Yeah, I'm pretty much the same. I've got 3 kids all under 6 and during the pandemic, this is not related to the pandemic because that was brutal. Our kids were home from school, often had just a kid sitting in here with me trying to just watch a TV show on one of my monitors while I was trying to get some code done. And that sucked because like my wife works as well. So we're just trying to make it work. But hopefully, fingers crossed,
just trying to function.
We're through the end of that and we don't have online school anymore. But when they are in school, it's pretty, or even just during the summer, we have whatever. I just have very clear boundaries. I work in the summer. I work from 9:30 to 4:30 every single day. And that allows my wife to have a bit of a workout in the morning, as well as a couple hours before dinner, like an hour and a half before dinner to get some stuff done around the house. It's just a nice clean cut thing. And during the winter, I just work 9 to 5. I drop the kids off usually about 9:30 sometimes if there's traffic after dropping the kids off. But Monday, Friday, 9 to 5. People ask me this all the time. Like, how do you manage it? I'm like, I just literally work during work hours and then you don't work during non-work hours. And it, like Scott says, if there's something fun that you want to do that is coding related, then that's in your downtime. And whenever you've got like an hour in the evening or whatever, you can absolutely go for that type of thing. So that's kind of what I do. I am pretty lenient with jumping out of work early on a Friday or whatever, just because like I know that my kids are going to remember that type of thing where we went out for breakfast and I started late, or I took a half day off and went to the cottage or something like that. And that's also just like a perk of working for yourself and being able to manage that type of thing. But generally, I'm pretty firm with my hours, and that's about it. I don't work on weekends. I don't work on nights.
Yeah. And honestly, it's something that I struggle with, you know, because I am very used to being like independent. You know, I can go code, I can do whatever I can.
Yeah.
And once you have kids, all that's out the window. And it's been not like a hard transition for me, but it hasn't always been easy. There are certainly times where I find myself picking up my computer and Courtney has to be like, hey, you know what? Why don't we just, you know, close the computer for the day? And be like, yeah, that's actually, that's a great idea. That's a very good idea.
It's hard when you love this stuff so much, but yeah,
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. You don't want to pull yourself away, or, you know, we all get the feeling of like when you have like a really intense bug or problem you want to solve and you can't solve it, you got to like shut your brain off for a little bit while you're with the kids and be present. And also, you know what? There's something to be said for, you know, the benefit of workplace that allows you to bail out a little bit early on a Friday or take a day off to do whatever here and there without being really stressful about it. Like, I think, you know, at the end of the day, I would love to be a 4-day work environment, you know, full time for anybody who works for Level Up Tutorials, right? That would be like a great thing where people wouldn't, you know, they could take a full day with their kids that's a non-weekend or whatever. So yeah, it's a tough balance, but you got to make it work. Another tough balance that you have to make work is the amount of errors on your site, as in you shouldn't be having that many of them if they're affecting a lot of people. And how can you tell how many errors are affecting a lot of people? Well, you can use a service like Sentry. Let me tell you, we just launched a new UI for our website, so we have errors. You'd think that you wouldn't have any errors with all your tests and all that stuff, but let me tell you, we have errors. And we have been on Sentry nonstop. We've been watching these errors. We've been seeing how many people they're affecting, who they're affecting. It gives us the user object, the user ID of the user, the browser. It gives us any information that we could possibly need to solve these errors. And you know what I've been hitting a lot of? I've been hitting a lot of that resolved button, because what I do is I fix the errors and then I click the resolve button and then that never, ever, ever, ever come up again because I fixed it right the first time. And so you can have that kind of feature along with performance tracking tools and all sorts of other stuff and more at sentry.io. Use the coupon code TASTYTREAT, all lowercase, all one word, and you'll get 2 months for free. This is definitely an offer you're going to want to try, especially if you have any, if you have user-facing code, you're going to want a service like this, because otherwise those errors are just going to go unnoticed. So you don't want to sweep those under the rug. You want those to be in front of your face. Thank you so much to Sentry for sponsoring.
Next question is from Lewis Blundell. Should I write a portfolio site just using the three fundamentals, HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, or should I write them using something I am comfortable with, such as Angular or React? Unsure if using a framework for a portfolio is a good idea. I think using your portfolio site as a playground for something that you're learning is a fantastic use case. And also, like I talked about this on a past episode, is I built my wife a little website in HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. And then I scrapped the thing and went for, I built it in SvelteKit and I used Prisma on my back end just because, like, even for the smallest website, I feel like it is so much handy to be able to update the thing yourself and to have it auto deploy and have just like reusable components where you're not just having to copy paste code over and over again. So yeah, I think being able to have a playground, try new stuff out on your personal website, as well as just the actual benefit of a framework, is a good idea. I would go with some sort of framework for it.
I would too. And you know, people, purists might scoff at that, but you know, your portfolio isn't always just what is the smallest, tiniest little website we can produce that loads the fastest. Now, granted, you want things to load as fast as possible. You want your thing to be performant. That's something you want to be. But you know, there is that like reductionist example where it's like, this is the fastest website ever. Yeah, because they're not loading any images. It's just straight up HTML.
That drives me crazy.
It drives me crazy because that's not real world, right? If I saw that as somebody, you know, interviewing somebody, I would say, okay, but this is not the product that we're building. And chances are, if you're interviewing for jobs, they're not hiring you to build that kind of site. They're most likely hiring you to build something more dynamic. So what you want here is to show that you can work in the type of thing that you're trying to get a job at. So if you're trying to get a React job, make that site React, something Next.js, Gatsby, something that's going to be fast, small, quick, whatever. Whatever you're trying to get a job in, you make that site in that technology, and then you make it really stinking good. You make it very fast. You make the code impeccable, because chances are you're going to throw that baby on GitHub. And if I'm your person who's going to be potentially interviewing, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pop open that code. I'm going to look at that code. I'm going to see, how clean is this code? It doesn't need to be commented it to you know, this button opens the menu. Yeah, okay, we get it. But what we need here is we need just code that looks good, so that when somebody opens it up, they'll say, oh yeah, this person, I would like this type of code and this style of code to be in my code base. So that's really what you're trying to illustrate, is that you can do the work that you are going to be hired to do. And your personal portfolio site is the perfect place to show that off, in my opinion, at least. Okay, next question is from Brian Barracuda Mayor. Pretty cool. We got a Barracuda on the program. How do you handle hosting when using WordPress as a headless CMS with something like Gatsby? So, Wes, I'm going to let you take this one because I don't do a ton of WordPress hosting anymore. And in fact, every single time I suggest it, I say, oh, use Bluehost. And Wes is like, don't use Bluehost. So you can tell me where to host the WordPress site.
Yeah, I don't necessarily know if I'll tell you where to host it, but the type of hosting that you'll need for the back end and the front end might be a little bit different. So hosting WordPress, you need like a PHP server to host that thing on. And that's probably the most common type of hosting out there. I know a lot of people, I'm not going to make any recommendations just because I've been out of that space for a while. Just don't use Bluehost. So you need some good PHP hosting that is on a server somewhere. You can put your Gatsby website on the exact same server. And that's probably a very affordable way to do it. It's just that when you are hosting Gatsby, you need a good CI integration, meaning that whenever your data in your WordPress changes, you need to rebuild your Gatsby website. And these things like Netlify, Cloudflare Pages, what is it? Render is what you're using. What are the other ones? Zite. What are some other of these good?
Render, Netlify.
Yeah, you get the point. Those things are really good at building your website and deploying it. That's not to say you couldn't. Even like Gatsby Cloud could even do that. Gatsby Cloud will build your website and then it will put it somewhere. And that somewhere could be back on your PHP server, because all you need at the end of the day to host a Gatsby website is just a static server with an Nginx or an Apache config that... Actually, you don't even need the Apache config, because Gatsby renders out the folders for you. So yeah, that's not even necessary. So I would probably start with that, is that try to host it both on the same server. And if you find that the CI is flaky or being a pain in the butt, then go for something like Netlify, Cloudflare Pages, Render, something that will build it for you every single time that your data changes, or every single time you click a button and you want to rebuild that type of thing. Next question is from Steve Lewis from the UK. How frequently do you use div tags versus finding the better tag? Love the pod, BTW. Thanks, Steve Lewis from the UK. This one's pretty simple. Try to use the best tag that you possibly can at first. So don't default to a div. Default to saying, can I use And this will take a bit at first, but can I use main, article, header, footer, aside, any of these things that are descriptive of what the content is? And if not, then use a div or use a span if it's an inline element. I think that's a pretty simple little rule of thumb there.
Yeah, for the most part, div is where you have like a switch statement. Div is the default one, right?
Yeah.
So you go through all the options that it could possibly be ahead of time. And if it's none of those options, it's a div or a span. Span for inline, div for block. And that's pretty much it. I do use a fair amount of divs because, let's face it, there's no reason to shoehorn some other component in there when it doesn't have to be. So, I mean, anytime you have an arbitrary like divider or section of code, div tag is usually going to be the place to be, unless it is, of course, one of those main ones. And you'll know it just by getting used to it. That's the type of thing that you definitely feel more comfortable with. In fact, that was one of the things that I had in my Google interview was they gave me like a layout and they were like, what would you make each of these things? What HTML element would you make each of these things? And I thought that was always a really fascinating exercise, because it like showed your understanding of these. And oftentimes there's a right and a wrong answer, but not all the time. Sometimes it's not black or white. So just use whatever you think is appropriate based on the type of content it is, whatever the semantic meaning of that content is. And then if you can't think of anything or then they don't feel bad about using a div, they're there for to be these blank containers. Okay, next question is from Kirky. Kirky says, this is less of a question and more of a heads up for other listeners. Beware of scam job opportunities. I recently encountered a scam where they used a website that seemed like a very normal and reasonable job board for a major company. I went through the whole process until they asked for personal info and I asked for verification of their person. They could not provide it, so I left. But they had profiles matching actual employees at the company. They had emails, they had an HR department and employees, they had a legitimate operation going on. Make sure to take a second look and verify with the company before giving personal information away or depositing any of their money in your account. Yeah, this is a good one because as developers, you know, once you get a little bit into your career, you've had a role or two, you probably get a lot of people reaching out to you on LinkedIn about other job opportunities because there's a lot of headhunters on LinkedIn who are just scanning for hashtags and whatever to see what you do. And I'm pretty sure that that seems like a decent attack vector for somebody to say, you know what, you know, these people are desperate for jobs or, you know, give me that social security number, huh? And yeah, then we'll move forward here. So no, I've never fallen for a scam like this. Wes is asking me in the comments, Scott, have you ever fallen for a scam like this or almost fell for one? Nope. I am extremely skeptical about any of this stuff. Text messages, whatever. If yeah, I get an incoming call, whether that is a call coming in from anywhere, whether that is the phone or anything like that, I think the general rule is to not accept that and then reach out to them on your own via their official channels. Sometimes it's very obvious. These are real companies. Like if Ford is reaching out to me and it's Ford, I'm not going to be like, huh, are you sure this is Ford? Like, you know, I can tell the difference between some major ones there, but if it's something that I've never heard of, that's a whole nother story.
I always feel bad for people like this. Like my neighbor got her Facebook hacked the other day and she's like, I'm investing in new opportunities. And like, that's not something she would ever post. And one of her friends is like, wow, interesting. I would like to hear more. I was like, really?
Really?
Come on. Like, I feel so like that's the most basic one. I feel like I have a pretty good vibe check for that type of thing. But last summer, I almost got scammed. This is not tech or business related, but I took the engine out of my Sea-Doo. I gave it to some guy who a friend had recommended and who could rebuild it for me. And so I gave it to him. And then I called him. He's like, yeah, no problem. I'll get you in the water in a week. And then like a couple of weeks went by and I was like, hey, what's going on? He's like, oh, I'm waiting on parts. And it started to be that whole excuse game over and over again. And I started to do a little bit of research on just like his name and a bunch of information he had. And turned out like every time he called me, I got like a different number. And I was like, this guy's got burner phones. And then I finally found this thread on a Sea-Doo form of this guy who just like takes your boat and then just runs with it or takes all the parts out and leaves a shell. And I was like, oh man, I can't believe I got scammed. So I went deep on this guy. Like I found his real name. I found all of his numbers, all of his burner numbers.
He slashed the tires on his cars.
I found his shop address. And like, this is not the kind of guy that you want to approach because like, it's crazy. So like, I would not like go up to him because like, worst case, he had like a $2,000 motor of mine. But then I like he kept picking up the phone because he wanted to like get more money out of me because I had paid him a deposit.
Ugh.
And then finally, after I had all the information on him, I even like, I pulled records from Florida and where he had bought a motorhome from somebody, or he had like got a $100,000 motorhome and then just turned around like he on credit and then he sold it. And that was like Grand Theft Auto. So he has like a $100,000 Grand Theft Auto. And it went even as deep as he was involved with like the previous president of the United States scams. I won't go too much deeper, but there's all these news articles about him that I found. I was like, this guy is a pro. But the other thing was that he was also like a known guy in the like 80s Sea-Doo racing scene. So he also did know what he was talking about. Like he was just like a scammer in the industry. I gathered all this info and I called him up. And I called him by his real name, which made him stumble a little bit because he had given me the wrong name. I was like, I just want to know, like, I know everything about you and I work in cybersecurity and you definitely don't want to be screwing me. And he said, wow, like, I don't really work in cybersecurity, but I'm freaking really good at Googling stuff. So you could tell it rattled him. And within a week or two, he got me the motor. It worked fine. Like, he obviously knew what he was doing and he buttoned everything up and got it right back to me because he knew that like he didn't want to be caught and he knew I had all the info. So that's my crazy story of almost being scammed. And I pride myself of not being the guy who gets scammed, but that was crazy.
Coming in hot is Wes, yeah. Badass Boss with a little bit of a reverse scam. Hey there, that's pretty nice. Hey, and I got another one for you. C-Doo, how about C-While? You know, like a do-while loop?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, C-Doo, C-While. Yeah, okay, those are...
How are you going to pull this together, Scott?
How am I going to pull together what?
Are you trying to get an ad read here?
No, but here, you can see me do a website... While you see while me hosted on Linode. How about that?
Hey, there you go. That was probably the furthest stretch I've ever heard. But let's talk about Linode. They are cloud computing that developers trust. You probably know them for their VPS, and they will host a website for you. No problem. You can actually, they got $100 in free credit that they'll give you. You can take that and spin up a server. You could host your Gatsby site on that. You could run PHP on it and host your WordPress website. But they also have dedicated CPU machines. They have DDoS protection, DNS management. They've got block storage. If you want to throw your images on there, you want to host a bunch of big files, they have object storage. They'll back it all up for you. They have a GPU, bare metal, Kubernetes, you name it. Anything you need to do with hosting, it's very affordable and very good. Their customer support is top notch. So you want to check it out. They got $100 in free credit if you go to linode.com/syntax and sign up with the free account. You're going to get $100 in free credit, which is a really sweet deal. Thank you, Linode, for sponsoring.
Sick. Cool. Well, one last question here from Tisha Mervahill. What percentage of North Americans keep their mobile devices longer than 3 years, 5 years, 8 years? I'm a freelancer and want to put a clause in my contract of what age of device my app will support. I can't seem to find this information. Just more general answers, like most people expect a phone to last 2 to 3 years. Yeah, this is a tough question to answer because I think it's extremely different based on where you're living, what type of population you're dealing with. And honestly, the browsers and the operating systems and things like that, they update themselves to stay on top of whatever. So this is actually a very different answer for Android and iOS, because in the Android world, you end up probably having phones that are kept for longer and that get less or OS updates. But unlike iOS, the browser updates independently of the OS, which honestly makes an endless amount of sense considering that's how that's always worked, right? And we have these Safari updates tied to the OS. Doesn't make any amount of sense to me whatsoever. But at least iOS people are more likely to have a newer, more updated device with a later operating system, in my opinion, than like an Android user. But an Android user, they probably have a later browser version because it updates on its own automatically. So I have no idea. You know, I currently have my phone for 3 years now or so. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I usually upgrade my phone every 2 to 3 years myself, but I don't think that's normal or average.
That's normal for like tech people.
Yeah.
But like if I look at, I took my wife's 3-year-old phone and gave it to my mom and she's had it for like 2 years and she's like, always like, this thing's great, you know, like,
oh, yeah, totally.
It never hits any issue. But it's more like what I tell my clients when I used to do this type of thing is I support the last two major versions of every browser. And usually that will cover most iOS and Android devices. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. If they need it to support, you can also take a look at their Google Analytics and say, oh, like 80% of your people are on 7-year-old Android devices, then that's going to cost a little bit more because that's not the type of stuff that I normally do. Or, hey, we're not able to do X, Y, and Z. We'll have to progressively enhance for most browsers, but some people on older browsers. And even like to book a COVID vax shot in Ontario, you couldn't do it on IE.
Mm, yeah.
Which I was like very proud of our government for being like, yeah, like, come on, move along. And I think that probably would have been a bit different if they said you can't book it on a 8-year-old Android device, because for a lot of people, that's their only internet. But I think like Internet Explorer is like, well, you're sitting at a computer anyway, then just open something else. And most likely you're on a old corporate computer and you need to just download another one or download the Edge version of that. So that's a bit of a non-answer, but you just kind of have to put the last two major versions. That usually covers 3 or 4 years worth of browsers. And if you have to do any more than that, then you have to figure out how much extra work that will take you.
Yeah, totally. It's so funny. You should have like a little thing that pops open if you're still having to support, or if you're using IE11 in 2021, it pops open the site and it's just a little guy being like, what are we doing here? Like, what's happening? Why are you using this? Yeah, I have no idea. Honestly, this is a tough one to answer. Certainly not something that we have the data on. So, okay, now is the part of the show where we do sick picks, things that we find to be sick that we've picked to share with you, things that we enjoy. And Wes, I got a sick pick for you that I think you're going to like.
I'm into it.
Yeah, this is on Amazon Prime Video. And this is a show that we started watching and we binged it instantly. There's 4 episodes of it. And if you are into, was it The Dream, that MLM podcast?
Yeah.
This is Lou LaRiche, and it's a series about LuLaRoe.
Oh.
And it's 4 episodes about why LuLaRoe is a giant scam. But it also, like, it's so funny because, like, the founders of LuLaRoe, they're so trained at playing dumb to the whole thing. They're like, well, we're just trying to help people. And then they'll be like, they'll show their legal interviews and they'll be like, did you ever know about this? And she'll be like, never heard of it. And then they'll cut to somebody else and be like, yeah, this person told me directly this was the thing. And they're just, they're the biggest scammers. They're the worst people in the whole world. They're terrible people. You'll get a little bit of overlap with other MLM stuff, but I thought it was super fascinating. I didn't know anything about LuLaRoe, and this kind of blew my mind a bit.
Well, how do you spell it? Because I just Googled it and it's a LuLaRiche Chevrolet dealership in Plymouth, Michigan.
LuLaRiche, like this, one word. And it is wild. It is very entertaining. It's very well produced. And the type of thing that I love, these kind of like scammy, whatever documentaries, whatever.
Yeah.
So I've really dug this high production value, you know, horrible people, the whole deal.
I am into that. I think I'm going to try to convince Caitlin to watch that tonight. She likes that type of stuff too. So
yeah, and it's fashion too. So I know she's into that world. Yeah.
That's awful fashion.
Well, yeah, it is. I know.
That's the most amazing part to me is that people would wear that. I don't know. I should talk about the stuff I wear, but man.
Yeah, look at me. I'm currently have a hood over my headphones. I'm and my hair is, I look terrible. But in the same regard,
I was wearing the same hoodie today.
We were watching that show with Courtney. I would be like, what part of this would make you be like, oh man, I gotta sign up for this to get these ugly clothes. I gotta sign up. Yeah.
Makes no sense, but cool. I'm gonna check that out. I've been doing some sick repicks lately just because there's certain things in my life I'm just like, that thing was awesome. So about a year ago, I sick picked these flame bulbs where you screw them into any existing light bulb.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And they have like a flame effect. And it is, you might think, oh, that's stupid, that's cheesy. So convincing that it's an actual flame. It looks so good.
Every like house in our neighborhood right now has like these like lanterns outside with those flame bulbs in them. And every time we walk by and we're like, man, these look great. These look really good. Yeah.
They are so cool. And like, even if you put one in like a pumpkin or something, a couple of years ago, I had watched Adam Savage and he took one apart and put it in like a lantern. And he says, these things are meant to run on like household power, 120 volts. But I took it apart and looked at it and it doesn't run on 120. It runs on 3 volts, just 3, which is conveniently enough. How many volts is 2 AA batteries? So my kids got this little Coleman lantern at a yard sale and it didn't work. And I took it all apart and all the wires were broken and everything like that. And I was like, okay, I'm going to make this thing sick. So I cracked open one of these bulbs and mine said 12 volts on it. But I tried a 9-volt like square battery and it worked great. So I converted my kid's lantern to 9-volt and it has like a flame effect inside of it now. Like I just replaced the entire, you take the like screwy bulb part off and I just soldered it right to the board of the actual thing. And it looks amazing. And it's been running for like 6 hours on a single battery and not slowing down at all. And I was just like looking at it. I was like, these bulbs are so cool, especially if you, Halloween's coming up, you put them in your porch light or something like that. They also will tell when it's upside down. So if you put the bulb upside down, it makes the flame go the other way.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Huh.
So they have little ones and like the regular socket. I don't know what sockets are called. E26 is a regular household socket and E12 is the little lamp ones. We got a couple of both.
What about E40?
What's E40?
He's like a South Bay rapper.
Oh, American rapper. Oh, man, that's funny. No, they don't have E40. So that's my sick pick. Check it out. Flame bulbs.
Cool. All right. Shameless plugs. I'm going to shamelessly plug leveluptutorials.com. We have a new series on web components, and it's web components for those of you who have no experience with web components or want to learn the foundational skills around it. And it's really neat. We use no libraries, no build tools, just straight up JavaScript and HTML on the browser in real script tags. And it's awesome. So you get a real handle of how we can build legitimate, accessible, full-time components in your applications using web components. And it's really, really neat. No more hiding behind other libraries that do a bunch of the stuff for you. We got this. So check it out on leveluptutorials.com/pro if you want to sign up to become a Level Up Pro and get access to a new series every single month.
I'm going to shamelessly plug my beginner JavaScript course. You can check it out at beginnerjavascript.com. It's a fun exercise heavy approach to learning modern JavaScript from scratch. So whether you know a little bit of JavaScript or you're totally a beginner, but you want to get to that sort of intermediate level, this is a course for you. We do a lot of exercises in this course. We build a lot of fun things. So you learn along the way of making some fun stuff. And it's also good for your portfolio. Check it out. Use coupon code SYNTAX for an extra $10 off beginnerjavascript.com.
Sick.
That's it. I'll talk to you later. Peace.
I will talk to you later too. Peace. Head on over to syntax.fm for a full archive of all of our shows. And don't forget to subscribe in your podcast player or drop a review if you like this show.